Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Legend has it that 250 years ago today, a group of ragtag but intrepid patriots gathered here to sign the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence. May 20th, 1775 was more than a year before our founding fathers signed and released the Declaration of Independence that Americans have come to revere. Written in that document is the observation that those who affixed their signatures to it were pledging their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honors to the effort. Interestingly, that exact phrase, and others with which we are familiar, can be found in the Mecklenburg Declaration, leading some to wonder if the MECDEC influenced Thomas Jefferson, or if, given the uncertainty of the Mecklenburg Declaration's existence, some fiction writers borrowed that from Mr. Jefferson. Despite the uncertainty, the Mecklenburg Declaration is part of our history, and fiction or fact, its signing has been observed annually every year since 1995, not too long ago. This hour, a fact-finding mission on the authenticity of that document. Scott Seifert is co-founder and chairman of the May 20th Society. That's a nonprofit dedicated to commemorating the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence. He's also chairman of the Charlotte Trail of History and a partner at the law firm Moore & Van Allen. Nolan Dahm is an historian and exhibits manager at the Charlotte Museum of History. And David Fleming is the author of four books, including Who's Your Founding Father? One Man's Epic Quest to Uncover the First True Declaration of Independence. I wonder which one that is. He is also a Peabody-nominated correspondent for Meadowlark Media. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being in the studio with us. Welcome.
Good morning.
Happy MECDEC Day.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. We'll be celebrating after at 10 o'clock this morning. Scott, you, sir, because you've been on the show in the past several times with me, you are a true believer. When you've been on this past, we've talked about why you believe, but I'm going to ask you again, because you are the co-founder, as I said, and the chairman of the May 20th Society, which is about the Mecklenburg Declaration. What makes you so sure that this document existed?
Well, so the totality of evidence when I started looking at this 20-something years ago, and I kind of went into it with a bit of a skeptic's mentality, which was, okay, this is an interesting, cute local story, but what's really behind this? And what I was astonished to find was how much evidence there really was. That you had eyewitnesses, you have circumstantial evidence of the people here, you've got the local legends, but most importantly, you have the eyewitnesses. In 1831, you have 12 very good eyewitnesses, including Presbyterian elders and generals and so forth, all sort of attesting exactly what happened in more or less the same way. Now, as we all know, the original single piece of paper, if there was one, is lost in a fire in April of 1800. So the MECDEC sort of folks have that piece of evidentiary problem to contest with. But, you know, as I went through and researched and found my book, there was so much evidence for it, it just seemed impossible that it couldn't be true.
You're an attorney. Can you argue both sides of this case?
Probably, yes, I could, if I had to.
Nolan, you're with the Charlotte Museum of History. You are an historian. So I'm just curious about, because history can often be murky. I'm curious where you come down on this.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I think when I moved here and started in my position, I would have called myself a full skeptic of the MECDEC. You look it up, you Google it, you hear this cute story, you look on NCpedia, that's our Wikipedia for North Carolina. And the first line is basically like, it's a legendary document that is said to have existed. And basically the official state archives position is it's fake. And so as a historian, I think I defer to those experts and I say, all right, it's a fake. And then kind of like Scott, as I was developing this exhibit that just opened today at the museum, I think that I have become more and more convinced that some really important stuff happened on May 20th. So I won't go as far as to say that I think the MECDEC is real. I don't know if I'm there yet, but I do think that I'm much more convinced that it something like it was real than I was even 6 months ago.
Which brings us to you, David. If I'm not mistaken, you're a sports writer for ESPN. Is that correct?
Long time, yes.
Okay, and yet you took the time to research your book that you were on this program last year to talk about, Who's Your Founding Father? One Man's Epic Quest to Uncover the First True Declaration of Independence. Why? Why did you endeavor to do that? Because that's a lot of work.
It is. Thanks to Scott and the May 20th Society, I became obsessed with the story. After moving here, realizing we love this place, we're going to raise our family here, all I did was glance at the state flag and wonder, what's May 20th, 1775 doing on the state flag? And down the rabbit hole I went, and 10 years later, I'm sitting here with you guys this morning on MechDeck Day, but the niche that I had carved out at ESPN was stories that were sort of like profoundly strange and strangely profound. And when you learn the MechDeck story, you realize this is a story that only comes along once in a lifetime, I think.
And you have called Charlotte literally, these are your words, literally the cradle of American independence. Are we the only city, jurisdiction, municipality outside of Philadelphia to claim this?
Well, we should be. I mean, it's today is MechDeck Day, and I have no doubt in my mind. I started this project as a skeptic as well. The book was going to be way more sort of like tongue in cheek, get a load of what they think happened in Charlotte, and then you look at the evidence. It's overwhelming. It's irrefutable. There's no way to look at it and not come away with an understanding that, that Charlotte is the cradle of American independence. And to me, the biggest controversy is, what's the deal with Charlotte, and why won't this place embrace this?
Nolan, he just said it. The evidence was incontrovertible. It's there in black and white. You're still on the fence. Why does he think it's absolutely true? You think something happened. And I think Scott over here is a believer. As much of a true believer as we can have.
As you
here.
Can get.
As you can get. Nolan, why?
Well, I think an important day, as Scott mentioned it earlier, it's September of 1800. And that's the first document, in my opinion, where we really have somebody writing down that the MechDeck happened on May 20th, 1775. Mm-hmm. And maybe Scott will disagree with me on that. But what I'm referring to is something called the Davy Copy. And you might know that name Davy. He was the William R. Davy. He was the founder of UNC Chapel Hill. And he met up with a guy named John McNitt Alexander, the secretary of the MechDeck Convention. And basically, John McNitt's house had burned down earlier that year. He meets up with William R. Davy, and he uses some of his notes and his memory to write down notes about what burned down in his house. And for me, I think, you know, that is why I'm a little bit skeptical, is because no matter whether the MechDeck existed or not on May 20th, the words that we now call the MechDeck are 100% based on memory and notes. We do not know what that original text was. So that's why I hedge a little bit, is because to say that what we call the MechDeck today is the same thing that Hezekiah and John McNitt and Thomas Polk called the MechDeck in 1775, those are not the same thing.
We're going to talk about why this document doesn't exist, because it seems to me that if this document existed, and we'll talk about the fact that it was allegedly delivered to the Continental Congress in Philadelphia, what happened to that one? We'll talk about that in a second here. But when the 56 signing members of the Philadelphia Declaration of Independence met, they met in May for the first time of 1775. Coincidentally, the exact same month that the rebels in Charlotte met and allegedly signed this declaration and called for a separation from Great Britain. This is a year and some months before the signers of the Philadelphia Declaration had the guts to put their name, and it really took guts to put their name on that document. Let's not minimize that.
On the MechDeck, you mean?
No, on the National Declaration.
Oh, I guess I'm already disagreeing, because, I mean, we are essentially already at war.
Well, yeah, we were already at war when the Continental Congress met, but you put your name on a document that says, King George, we're done with you. That's treason. So what made the people in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, so far ahead so much more gung-ho right. than the Philadelphia founders.
Well, and this is a critical part of the story as well, was the context of who these people were. So these are Scots Irish Presbyterians largely who had left Pennsylvania, had moved here to live in their own religious community in the woods. They're very anti-English. They're very anti-Anglican church. They were mostly kicked out of the Presbyterian church because they were so militant. Mm. So you got to understand the sort of people that lived here. So when all of a sudden sort of British landlords start arriving and say, hey, you owe us taxes, or if you want to get married, you have to pay a fee, and you're paying taxes for Anglican church, they detested the British. So the story really... The Charlotte Mecklenburg story, in many sense, explains why this could only have happened here. It's not a big city. You don't have a lot of commercial interests with Great Britain and shipping and so forth. So these people were ripe for exactly this sort of thing. And we know this as circumstantial evidence. So after the war, you have, of course, Cornwallis calling this a hornet's nest rebellion. You have all these British letters. You know, my favorite quote is from Bannister Tarleton's post-war memoirs, where he says it was evident and frequently mentioned to the king's officers that the counties of Mecklenburg and Rouen were more hostile to England than any other in America.
Wow.
What does that tell you? So wow. that's yeah, the mentality, the sort of mens rea, we would say, in law, explains a lot of this. I think.
So go ahead.
I think that's a really good point. In context, it would have been stranger for Charlotte. There was a sort of perfect storm going on with the people who moved here to get away from the king, the religious indoctrination through this sort of militant part of Presbyterianism, and then the circumstances that were going on. It was this perfect storm that formed the Mech Deck. And it's also, right. in my mind, it would have been stranger if these men had not declared independence. That's how fiercely against the tyranny of the church that they
were. And I would just add, you know, there's a lot of evidentiary paperwork problems with this whole story. We all recognize that's just a fact, and that cannot be fixed. But just think about, why would Captain Jack go in the midst of all this maelstrom? Why would they send him to Philadelphia, which is uncontested by even your most anti-Mech Deck people, that they sent a messenger? I mean, the governor of North Carolina reports to London about it. Why would that happen if nothing important had gone on?
So we know, Nolan, many of the people who signed the Philadelphia Declaration, they're famous. John Hancock, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, who helped write it, Benjamin Franklin, who was kind of the soul and heart of the Continental Congress. Our declaration was signed by, allegedly, Thomas Polk, the richest man in Mecklenburg County at the time. You mentioned Alexander. He's another relatively famous person from this area. Who else's name should we know who were participants in this act of treason?
Well, given my job, I can't not mention Hezekiah Alexander.
Of course.
He's the at the Charlotte Museum of History, we are the stewards of his home, the 1774 Rock House. So he was one of the guys who signed it. We've got his brother was John McNitt Alexander, who I mentioned earlier. Folks like Ephraim Brevard. We've got Thomas Polk. We've got John Query. Basically, in the exhibit, there's a really helpful map, if this was a visual medium, but it basically shows that they were spread out all through Mecklenburg County, even down close to what we would now call South Carolina, and up into the northern parts as well of the Piedmont. So they were folks who were generally owners of a lot of property. Thomas Polk, as you mentioned, was the richest man in Charlotte. Hezekiah had 600 acres on our site. They were generally wealthier leaders of Charlotte, folks who were elders in the Presbyterian Church and folks who were making a pretty good living off of a lot of the trading networks here in the area.
So some of these people are famous because of the streets in Charlotte and Davie County, which is obviously named after Mr. Davie. We have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more on this 250th anniversary of the signing of the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence, which was signed in the courthouse, which was at the time, I believe, on the square, what we call the square trade and try-on.
In the square,
because that's where it was, right in the middle of it, right? We will come back and talk about that and more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence, signed 250 years ago today on May 20th, 1775. You do the math. That's before the Philadelphia Declaration that we've come to know. With us, Scott Seifert. He's the co-founder and chairman of the May 20th Society, true believer in the MECDAC. Nolan Dahm is the historian and exhibits manager at the Charlotte Museum of History, where they've opened an exhibit today based on the Mecklenburg Declaration. And David Fleming is here. He's the author of Who's Your Founding Father? One Man's Epic Quest to Uncover the First True Declaration of Independence. So all the people who signed the Philadelphia Declaration, David, were patriots today, but they were committing treason back then against King George III. And when you consider that the war was already underway when they signed that document, and in fact, the war was already underway here when our folks allegedly signed the Mecklenburg Declaration, it would seem to me that took, I don't care how angry you are at the king, that took great courage. Those people had great courage. They did pledge their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honors, and all of that was very much at risk. Where's that kind of courage today?
Well,
that's a good question.
I get all the tough questions. Well, I mean, I think that's something we touched on earlier, right? I feel like what a great way for the city to sort of rally around this moment in history. And you make a really good point, right? Those 14 months between the MECDEC and the Declaration of Independence, some people call it the Jeff Deck.
lots of people say that.
Which I have to say, and this is not
I hear
me,
that all the time.
All the time.
This is Jefferson's own biographer said there. This cannot be a coincidence. Either Jefferson stole from the MECDEC or the MECDEC stole from Jefferson. So that's a really interesting wrinkle. But those 14 months are everything. And that's, again, why I feel like as a town, as a region, we need to respect this story and sort of honor the men who did this, because they really were, I feel like, again, these are Declaration of Independence scholars. It really was sort of like overdue paperwork that we needed something to sign. Mm. We're at risk of losing the war before we had even declared independence. So that's...
Well, of course, we were up against the most powerful army in the world.
Yeah, yeah. What I'm saying is that document was... Again, paperwork. Yeah. What the MECDEC did was, what those men did was truly, truly brave. And, I think I'm allowed to say badass, right? I mean, that was the men who founded Charlotte. That's what we're based on. The greatest controversy to me and the biggest thing I don't understand is why we don't embrace this as a town. It is everywhere. It hides everywhere in plain sight in Charlotte. But it feels like the spirit of it, we could use that more.
Nolan.
You know, I would add, I think the question is less why don't we honor it and how can we honor it? And I say that because for 250 years, Charlottians have been remembering the MECDEC. And in the exhibit, we get into this a little bit. One of the first main celebrations honoring the MECDEC was actually May 20th, 1861. And that was the year we seceded from the Union. Right. So what does that say about our memory of this period and how and who we choose to honor from 250 years?
Say that again. North Carolina seceded from the Union mm-hmm. on the anniversary of the signing of the MECDEC in 1861.
Yes. And they
and
did
that.
That
was purposeful.
That was purposeful. There are quotes from those delegates at that convention saying to honor at the spirit of our ancestors who declared themselves free of Britain on May 20th, 1775, we believe that the Lincoln government is more treasonous than King George's government. They're writing things like that in 1861. And, you know, similarly, on the flip side of that, 100 years later, 1960s, in 1963, Reginald Hawkins led a group of JCSU students protesting on MECDEC Day for civil rights. Again, explicitly referencing MECDEC Day, but sort of in some ways flipping it on its head. So again, I think for me, the question is less, why aren't people honoring the MECDEC anymore? And the question is more, how can we use this story of the MECDEC in the present day in a way that makes Charlotte better for everyone?
And as part, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, included in that group of celebrations are, is it four sitting presidents four sitting presidents. And in 1975, Gerald Ford came here. Billy Graham talked about the MECDEC. There were 100,000 people in Freedom Park celebrating MECDEC Day. So, yeah, it's fallen off quite a bit.
So as part of this exhibit at the Charlotte Museum, you have on display an article from the 1875 edition, an 1875 edition of Harper's Weekly, the 100th anniversary of the Mecklenburg Declaration. The mists of history weren't quite as thick back then, 1875. So what does that say about the veracity of this document?
Well, what I think it says about the veracity of the document is, again, you have to remember the time period. This is 10 years after the Civil War in a city that lost, that was the Confederate capital. And so they're looking for something to celebrate. And I think they're looking back on their history and they see the MECDEC as a period in Charlotte's history when Charlotte really was a national leader. And this is after all those debates, the debates between Jefferson and Adams, and the government puts out a report. And there's really all these debates through the middle of the 1800s and then the Civil War. And then again, I think Charlotte is asking itself, well, what is our identity? What do we have to grasp onto? And I think the MECDEC is where it's at. And that article you mentioned, shout out to Scott. He loaned it to us for the exhibit. That's in his personal collection. Oh. And it's a really great look at how Charlotte was remembering that.
And Harper's Weekly, it should be noted, was a major and a very important publication of its day.
I wonder, too, Nolan, do you think that the Civil War, that is part of the reason why the MECDEC faded, especially in the rest of the country? I feel like there was a feeling that it was like, well, Charlotte and the South, you lose your original claim to patriotism after you've declared war on your own country. And it was sort of punishment for that, that they were like, guess what? You guys are no longer the cradle of American independence.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, David.
Yeah.
And similarly, I would just add in the 80s and 90s, this was the biggest thing. It's a city and county holiday until the early 80s, right? It's still the date on the state flag. And
I'm taking the rest of the day.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. We all are. But also what happened is, Charlotte made a conscious decision at the time, right? It was going to be a new South City. We're building these new buildings. We don't need any of this old stuff. We're tearing it down. We're going to be banks and law firms and service industry stuff. And that was, one can debate the direction, but it was very effective. Mm-hmm. But they said, why are we talking about this old stuff? It's a complicated story. It's a bunch of people arguing about documents. It's got a controversy. Let's get away from all this. And history sort of became, especially in the South, quite unfashionable in the 80s and 90s. It had a lot of baggage, not so much in Charlotte as it did in Richmond or the deeper South. But this kind of got caught up in the swell of, let's stop talking about all this stuff.
So you're the lawyer here. Let's talk about the circumstantial evidence here that you can't prosecute this case on. The original document that was allegedly signed on this day 250 years ago burned up in a fire, as we've already mentioned. I know they didn't have copy machines back then, but the printing press did exist. No printed copies, no handwritten copies distributed or kept in other places. I mean, it was delivered allegedly to the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. What good is declaring something, your independence from Britain, if you're not going to publish it widely and people wouldn't have kept copies of what I would think at the time would have been a topic of conversation at the very least.
And also a souvenir also magazine. A death sentence. I don't think you're going to hang on to paper that would lead to your hanging.
Also, yeah, well, that's part of it. Why you would not. But remember, the purpose of it was, we have this now. Go to Congress and motivate them to do something about this. Mm-hmm. And so Jack goes to Congress, and the two North Carolina representatives he meets with are very loyalist. They're very Tory. One of them, Jefferson, after the Revolutionary War, says to Adams, he goes, you remember as well as I, there was no greater Tory in Congress than Hooper, who's one of the people that Jack met with. So, the other way to look at this is the original government cover-up. The Congress snuffed this out. They were not ready for this. They didn't want to deal with it. And that's where your documents went. And then
they didn't snuff out the Philadelphia Declaration.
A year and a half later.
The times had changed.
Times had changed.
We should also mention, I think somebody mentioned it already, that the British general, Lord Cornwallis, who would later surrender the British troops at Yorktown, was here in Charlotte in 1780, and he faced fierce resistance to the point where he described Charlotte as a hornet's nest of rebellion, hence the Charlotte Hornets name and the hornets on the badges and the vests of these patches for the Charlotte Police Department. John Adams, allegedly, was surprised by an article that he read in 1819 in the Essex Register about this document. And Thomas Jefferson dismissed it entirely, the whole document. Of course, if our document is real, then Jefferson would have a horse in this race. He would have a reason to deny that the thing ever existed, because several phrases that have become famous in his declaration are said to be found in the Mecklenburg. WFAE had Mecklenburg County Commissioner Mark Jarrell read the entire document. We aired it earlier today, and I want to play three passages from the MEC deck that, even if you've never heard of it, will sound eerily familiar to you. First, in Jefferson's declaration, he starts his reasoning for separating from Great Britain this way. He says, "When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another." The MEC deck says this:
"Resolved, that we the citizens of Mecklenburg County do hereby dissolve the political bands which have connected us to the mother country, and hereby absolve ourselves from all allegiance to the British crown."
The July 4th declaration waits until the last paragraph, but it too says the colonies are, quote, "absolved from all allegiance to the British crown." That document also uses the phrase "are and of right ought to be free and independent states." That phrase is altered slightly, but it's still found in the MEC deck.
"We do hereby declare ourselves a free and independent people, are and of right ought to be, a sovereign and self-governing association under the control of no power other than that of our God and the general government of the Congress."
Both documents refer to the inalienable rights of man, and both documents use a phrase that is unique in describing what was at stake for the signers. I've mentioned it several times. In Philadelphia, the last sentence of the Declaration says, "With a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." And in the MEC deck, something eerily similar:
"We solemnly pledge to each other our mutual cooperation, our lives, our fortunes, and our most sacred honor."
Nolan, as an historian, how do you explain these similarities?
You know, I'll be honest here, and maybe this is probably where I disagree most with Scott and David. I find it very hard to believe that Thomas Jefferson plagiarized the Declaration of Independence.
Good words is good words.
Good words is good words. And for me, I think it all comes back to this idea that whatever happened on May 20th, 1775, I don't think that those words that Commissioner Jarrell just read, I don't think they're the same words. That's not to say I don't think that the MEC deck existed. I think that some important, very important stuff probably was written on May 20th, 1775. But those words that we now call the MEC deck, those words that we read every year in Uptown, in City Center, those words are just sort of based on some notes and compilations of memories from 1819, around then, in the early 1800s. And
I got to interrupt. There are the original meeting notes, which include an outline of what they were going to put in the MEC deck, exist to this day, and they're in the Wilson Library Archives in Chapel Hill. I feel like there is, and I also think that there were surviving copies. I think the copy that you refer to, Scott, as in an unknown hand.
Right.
I always thought of that as a copy. I thought that was a copy of that had been copied by Thomas Polk's son before the fire, and that was also what McNitt Alexander used for to write the Davy copy. And I don't disagree that maybe we don't know the exact wording, but I would also like to point out that, yes, of course, Thomas Jefferson would never plagiarize something like "Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness," which was written by George Mason the week Thomas Jefferson put together the Declaration. So I would just say that in the last 20 years, we've learned that absolutely Thomas Jefferson is capable of plagiarizing and covering up something like borrowing from the MEC deck without acknowledging it. And I would disagree earlier, too. He in those letters back and forth from John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, which are incredible, right? That's might be my favorite part. They're discussing the MEC deck. Adams is like, I gotcha. You plagiarized it. Jefferson does not. If you read the full letter, he says, you know, if I'm shown more evidence, I would tend to go ahead and believe the MEC deck.
And we also have to realize that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson at the time of the exchange of those letters in the early 1800s were not really on speaking terms. They did not come to grips with each other until they were both on their deathbeds on the same day, July 4th. I've forgotten the year now.
But I mean, the snark in those letters, it's fantastic. And for people who think the rhetoric today is out of control, read those letters.
And you got to remember. And interestingly, you know, David's right. There's a little more nuance on Jefferson's point. He doesn't dismiss it. He says, if more solemn proof is produced, you know, I could believe this, but for the moment, I'm not. And let's go back to Adams. When Adams sees this in a paper, his first reaction is not, wow, this is interesting. That's kind of cool. This sounds familiar. His first reaction is, Jefferson plagiarized this.
So let's back up here. Adams sees this in 1819, and it's allegedly the first time he's seen it, and he is shocked that Thomas Jefferson has plagiarized this document, the Declaration of Independence. This was supposedly delivered to the Continental Congress a year before the Continental Congress produced their document. Wouldn't John Adams, wouldn't Thomas Jefferson, wouldn't the other signers have seen that document?
Maybe not.
Aware of that? Why not?
Because according to Jack, as the only eyewitness of that meeting, he gave it only to the two North Carolina representatives. And that's as far as it went. So it may have not got past anybody, past them.
I'm sorry, Mike.
That's okay.
Oh, I was just going to, I think this is one of the true sort of like one of the tragedies of the MEC deck story is that Jack delivers it. He risks his life. All these men risk their lives. He delivers it to Philadelphia. And it's at the exact time when they're still waiting to hear back from the olive branch letter to the king. So they're trying to tell the king, we don't want to fight. We don't want to be independent. And then this letter from Mecklenburg shows up and it says, we're already independent. Let's start fighting. So Jack delivers it to three representatives who are loyalists and essentially suppress it.
Yeah,
it's our own people, really, sort of.
It's the politician's fault, Mike. It's as simple as that.
I'll agree with that.
Well, they wanted to stick around for a while. They wanted to bind the nation's wounds, as it were, which wouldn't happen until much later. It still hasn't happened till this day.
We're working on it still.
That's right. Scott Seifert is here. He's the co-founder and chairman of the May 20th Society, True Believers in the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence, which celebrates its 250th birthday today. Also with us, David Fleming, author of Who's Your Father, about that document, and Nolan Dahm, the historian and exhibits manager at the Charlotte Museum of History, which opened an exhibit about this very day. We'll continue in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Scott Seifert, Nolan Dahm, and David Fleming, and we're talking about the 250th anniversary of the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence, which happens to be today. Now, I know that Channel 3 and WFAE and Channel 9 and Channel 36 and the Charlotte Observer were not around on May 20th, 1775, to publicize this notable event in Charlotte history, but clearly they read this from the courthouse steps before they got on a horse and galloped to Philadelphia to deliver it to the Continental Congress. No one took notes. No one reported this in whatever the daily rag or the weekly or the monthly publication was in Charlotte. No one reported this at all. No one ever. No one.
Well, I will agree with Scott and David. There is a lot of circumstantial evidence. There's plenty of different letters from local governors writing back to the king saying the residents of Mecklenburg declared independence and they told Captain Jack to deliver the info to Philadelphia. So, like, we do know that, again, as we've been discussing, something really cool happened on May 20th. Whether it's the exact document we now call the MEC deck, I don't know. But
you're so close. Just come on, Nolan. Come on.
You're almost there.
Come on.
I got to live in Charlotte for a few more years before I'm
take the red pill.
And I promise before the end of the show, we're going to get Mike to drop the alleged too.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Each paragraph of the Mecklenburg Declaration allegedly.
No more of that.
Begins with the word resolved. Mm. We heard one of them mentioned by Mark Jarrell. And some have said that may have be part of the confusion, because a couple of days later, 11 days later in 1775, that same group of ragtag patriots came up with the Mecklenburg, is it called the Mecklenburg Resolutions? The Mecklenburg Resolves. And according to a newspaper account, that document did not declare independence that many of those who claim to have signed the MECDEC maybe have confused that document and this alleged document. Because that document does exist, right? The Mecklenburg Resolves?
It does.
That they may have confused that and interpolated it, and maybe interpolated it with Mr. Jefferson's declaration because they wanted to sound good. So, what's your take on that, Scott?
So the Mecklenburg Resolves, to differentiate them from the MECDEC, have the effect of confusing everyone on what is already a very complicated story.
Okay.
For this reason. So you have the eyewitnesses who all give more or less the same story that on May 19th, May 20th, we declared independence and so forth. And so everyone's looking for documents and paperwork and letters to validate the story. And historians are writing books and pamphlets and so forth. When someone in the Charleston Library finds a newspaper from June of 1775, which contains a series of resolutions from Charlottetown, but they don't look or smell or sound like what the MECDEC is supposed to be like. They're very lengthy. They say things like, Mike, now that you're in charge, or now that we're free, you're in charge of gunpowder, we're going to have court every other Thursday, and so forth. And they're not dated the same day. They're not May 20th or May 19th or May 31st. Right. So what are these? They clearly exist. They're authentic. You can see them to this day in the Charleston Library.
And at the exhibit.
And at the exhibit. That's exactly right. And so if you are a skeptic of the story and you hate the story, right, you're a Jeffersonian, you say, this is all that happened. So all your eyewitnesses are all very good eyewitnesses. They're not lying, but they're all confusing or conflating in their minds this with something else.
Which is idiotic. These 13 men who we've relied on for other eyewitness accounts of the Battle of Camden, the Battle of Charlotte, all of a sudden they all collectively hallucinated on May 20th and thought this up. And I always think of the resolves as more corroborating evidence, because
right,
you wouldn't need rules for how you're going to run your society unless you had first declared independence. There'd be no reason. I mean, why would you need rules for here's guidelines for how we're going to be independent?
A declaration comes first.
It's an A and a B
yeah.
thing.
Okay, so
you're almost
there, Mike. Keep talking. No, I'm not. So we keep talking about these eyewitness accounts, and yet, Nolan, to the best of my knowledge, from what I've read about this, I mean, you can correct me, you're the historian here, there are no contemporary accounts, and there are no newspaper articles, there are no diary entries that we can find, no copies of the document. This should have been a tsunami, shouldn't it have been, to separate from the mother country and go against King George?
I think that's unfair, Mike.
Wait a minute. I watch Bridgerton, dear gentle reader. You would think that there would be some...
I'm sorry, I didn't realize you did extensive research with Bridgerton.
You would think there would be some kind of contemporaneous writing that could be uncovered to this day. People wrote letters back then. They kept notes.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's why folks like us, Mike, maybe maintain our skepticism, right? Is because, to your point, all these testimony that David and Scott are referring to, most of it was as part of a report that the governor commissioned in 1830. And so at the very best, these people are remembering stuff from 55 years ago. Some of them were children at the time, right? And they're remembering,
General Joseph Graham was a teenager who had served and defended Charlotte from Cornwallis and was wounded 9 times. And again, if we trust him, and I think the Charlotte Museum of History trusts his eyewitness account of the Battle of Charlotte, it seems to make sense that we can trust him for what he saw and experienced on May 20th. And Mike, I would also answer, it's not me or Bridgerton, but it's Pulitzer Prize winning author David McCullough, who said it makes sense that there's no There's no diary entries. There's no newspaper accounts, because this document would have been hidden, because they could have all been hung if it had become public.
The same would have been true in Philadelphia. I think John Hancock, when he put his big signature on that document, said, "Step up, guys, because my name's not going to be the only person's on this document. It's treason."
Well, and
we know about that. We know about that document.
Yeah, I mean, we'll just have to agree to disagree that, again, and these are Jefferson scholars who say it was a cut and paste job that was a rush job because they needed something to sign.
Okay, so Nolan, in fairness to these two believers, let me flip the script on you here for a second, because
sure.
Angel Johnston, who used to work at the Charlotte Museum of History, she was an education specialist there, points to some verified documents to show local leaders were working to break away from the British, and she says there are surviving letters from the royal governor of North Carolina saying, quote, "These people in Mecklenburg County are crazy. look what they're doing." Should we take that as an indication that he knew that a Declaration of Independence had happened, or simply that Mecklenburg County was a hotbed of rebellion?
Well, I mean, I think a little bit of both. Who you're referencing is Governor Arthur Dobbs. This was in the early 1760s. He writes a letter back to the king basically saying these residents of Mecklenburg County are lawless. They forcibly possess themselves of lands and they refuse to pay their taxes. And then he writes in that same letter, he talks about how basically residents of Mecklenburg County, the North Carolina tax collector would come and they would say, "What do you mean? We're from South Carolina." And then the South Carolina tax collector would come and they would basically say, "What do you mean? We're from North Carolina." And so there's a long history, 15 plus years before MECDEC, of residents of Mecklenburg County deciding we're only going to follow the laws that we want to follow. We're going to run this place the way that we want to run it. And so to your point, I definitely agree that there are a lot of these letters from royal governors explicitly recognizing residents of Mecklenburg County, even residents of Reedy and Sugar Creek. They're that specific about where this rebellious activity is.
They're
going
about
on.
To raise taxes again in Mecklenburg County. Can we still get away with saying we're from South Carolina? Can we still get away with that?
I don't know. We'll see. Well, what
not
Jason
not
said.
You two. Now Scott and I, we'll join up for that. But no, you two pay your taxes and be loyal.
Let me just pivot off that point. I mean, there is. It's incorrect to say there's no contemporaneous accounts of this, right? There is a letter from the royal governor in August of 1775 to his superiors in London, which reads, "The resolves which your lordship will find in this enclosed newspaper surpass all the horrid and treasonable publications that the inflammatory spirits of this continent have yet produced." So was he looking at? It was resolved. Where are they?
Where does that letter live today?
That letter lives today in the London War Records Office.
So David has been over. Does the attached newspaper article live there as well?
Oh, what a great question. Yes, I went all the way to London to look at that. And on the back of that letter, Dispatch 34 from Josiah Martin to the Earl of Dartmouth, saying basically, these guys have already declared independence. I need help. There was a newspaper, Cape Fear Mercury, with supposedly a copy of the MECDEC attached to that letter as proof. And it was on the back of that letter in the archives is a note from an archivist that said in 1843, a crony of Jefferson's took it out and destroyed it.
So we know that presidents come to towns across America for various different reasons over time. Sometimes they're just asked to be here and they're ceremonial decoration, and it's an honor to have them, allegedly. So presidents...
presidents usage was correct. That usage was correct.
Thank you very much. Presidents William Howard Taft, Woodrow Wilson, Dwight Eisenhower, and Gerald Ford all attended different MECDEC Day celebrations here in Charlotte. And in researching your book, David, you discover that several U.S. presidents and a number of historians have also embraced the existence of the MECDEC. Who were they and why did they reach that conclusion?
Well, obviously, they were brilliant historians who looked at the evidence and I think that's another myth, right? That there is like, oh, no contemporary historians agree with this. And it's the exact opposite. The list includes David McCullough, who we mentioned, Ken Burns, Cokie Roberts, Andrew Roberts, George Will, America's government teacher, Sharon McMahon, No less higher authority of law and legalese in North Carolina than the Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court. I would even add to
the
that
current
list,
Chief Justice.
Yes.
Okay.
Paul Newby.
Yep.
He's speaking today, actually.
Yeah. Okay. And I would add to that list, to the great shame of Charlotte, the Virginia Museum of History. They're on board with the MECDEC.
Really?
Yes.
So when Presidents William Howard Taft, Woodrow Wilson, Dwight Eisenhower, and Gerald Ford came here, were they true believers or were they just here to, because they were asked to be here? And
no, I think Howard Taft, I mean, he famously was like, anybody who says it didn't exist, I essentially brain those people. So, and I think it was Gerald Ford who sort of, it was the beginning of the end for the modern sort of MECDEC celebrations, because Gerald Ford came here and just sort of hemmed and hawed and wouldn't commit. And then he was followed on the stage by Billy Graham, who then I think tore up his original speech and gave a 45-minute off the cuff oration on the MECDEC, the MECDEC signers, and what they mean to Charlotte. He really showed up to Gerald Ford, I think.
Why did Billy Graham embrace it?
I think because of his family is connected to it. I think his descendants, he's a descendant of, is it General?
Joseph Graham, I believe.
Joseph Graham, yep. Yeah.
And through his Charlotte connections.
So you've been doing this a long time. You've been an evangelist for MECDEC Day for a long time, Scott. I'm just curious, is it picking up steam? In other words, when you started out, were there five true believers and now there are 500 true believers? I mean, how many are there?
Well, first we radicalized David, which was a great project of ours, as you can tell. That's
allegedly.
So when we started this 20-something years ago, there were five or six people that even, and I didn't know anything about it. Most of it, we just thought it was a cool booster story. Let's get involved. Why not? And yes, we've seen for the 250th, the energy and enthusiasm is beyond anywhere it's ever been. We're joking, we're a 20-year overnight success story. But, you know, what I say, too, is, you know, if you live in Charlotte, right, why wouldn't you embrace this, right? Unless you go deep into this and you really oppose it or you've done the research and you don't like it, that's fair enough.
It's because you moved here from Philadelphia.
That's true. But why would your default position be, well, actually, you know, we don't really know if they did this. I mean, imagine you lived in Boston. Every time the Boston Tea Party commemoration came up, people were like, well, it wasn't all tea. There was coffee involved, too. Well, and why do we, you know, we don't know that they really hated taxes. Maybe they just were unhappy that day.
I believe it's accurate to say that the people in Lexington and Concord argue to this day about where the war actually started, where the first shot heard around the world actually took place. So you and your organization, Scott, celebrate this every year. What's on tap this year?
So this year we've had a number of events. We've had three beer launches from local breweries.
Of course we did.
It's our second most important achievement. We had a moot court debate of high school teams from around the state debated in front of Chief Justice Paul Newby yesterday at the federal courthouse, which was a great event. And we have the noon commemoration today at noon, obviously on Uptown Charlotte. We're closing the square down. They're rebuilding the courthouse. Reenactors, and we expect to have, you know, maybe 1,000 people, maybe more there.
And as you would know, if you went to the Charlotte Museum of History and saw the diorama, you would know that the courthouse was actually in the middle of the square. You had to go around it to get through Trade and Tryon. But what else is at the exhibit at the Charlotte Museum of History for this celebration?
Well, you just mentioned the diorama. Mm-hmm. It's refreshed, renewed, added some new signage to it. That'll show you what Charlotte looked like on the eve of the signing of the MECDEC. In addition, we've got in that exhibit some weapons from some of the two different MECDEC signers, including John McNitt Alexander, who we mentioned. And in addition to some of the documents we've been talking through, for me, the most special thing in the exhibit is from 1826, the first separate print of the MECDEC. So you mentioned earlier, why didn't anybody use a printing press or whatever? Well, it was in the newspapers for a while in the early 1800s. And then, as far as we know, 1826, John McNitt Alexander's grandson commissioned a print of the MECDEC. There's only seven that we know of, and one of them is in the exhibit.
And it was printed in Ohio, as I understand.
Tennessee.
Well, why not here? We had ink. We had presses. after all your research, David, sum up your book. Why should we believe? You have 30 seconds.
Going off of what Nolan said about the weapons. I think one thing that we forget in talking about the controversy, which is a lot of fun, is the MECDEC was part of the spirit of rebellion, right, that helped this region turn the tide of the Southern campaign of the Revolutionary War. We can't forget that the MECDEC, you can draw a direct line between the MECDEC turning Cornwallis away, Kings Mountain, and changing the tide of the Southern campaign. And that's why I always say, I mean, the original title of my book was going to be You're Welcome, America, from Charlotte.
So, Scott, Nolan, here we are 250 years to the day from the signing of this document, and yet we still don't know that it actually existed. If we don't know by now, you're the historian. Will we ever?
Maybe. And that's the cool part about being a historian. I think everybody thinks that we just memorize stuff about the past, but we are doing history actively every single day at the Charlotte Museum of History. Of course, we're searching for that document, and we maybe will find it someday.
Nolan Dahm is the historian and the exhibits manager at the Charlotte Museum of History. Scott Seifert is co-founder and chairman of the May 20th Society and chair of the Charlotte History Trail. And David Fleming is the author of Who's Your Founding Father? One Man's Epic Quest to Uncover the First True Declaration of Independence. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.